sat out front in the nice morning sunshine for about an hour, and I enjoyed our conversation very much. Seems like a very sincere, honest, down-to-earth type person. I'll now give you Keith.
Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you, strong sponsorship and a little effort on my own. I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. It's a privilege for me to be able to be here today fully clothed and in my right mind, and it's always a privilege to be able to participate in the program and be able to be invited to come and be able to share on a program with my wife. She certainly deserves to have a little happiness. She went through all the hell with me, so anytime I can shine a little light on her side, why, it's a form of an amends, probably the greatest amends that I can make is to support her program and her sanity. And I'm very grateful for that. It's a special privilege to be able to do that. I don't know... If I'd be sober today, if it were not for Al-Anon, I'm certain that I would, Sue and I would not be together if it were not for Al-Anon. I am absolutely certain that my daughter and I would not have the relationship that we have today if it were not for the program Valentine and Al-Anon, which she is now an active member of Al-Anon. So I am very blessed. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that most of the families can come together if we let our past be our greatest asset, if we share openly and honestly with others, we can have the great reward. And our family is an example of that, if nothing else. We are an example of a program family that has mended something that was bent and broken and destroyed. And we share it as a family. Our house is in order, in other words, is what I'm trying to tell you, and I'm very grateful for that. I want to thank the committee for inviting us, and the room is beautiful, and fruit is, I don't think speakers say enough about those kind of things. I mean, it's a special thing to have that kind of warmth and welcome when you come a long way from home and you have somebody pick you up at the airport. My wife and I got up at 4 o'clock yesterday and got ready, and we left. One of the guys I sponsor picked us up and we drove an hour to the airport, and we waited in the airport for an hour and a half, and then we got a plane, and we flew to Chicago, and we waited for 4 or 5 hours in Chicago to get on a plane to come here and drive 2 hours to get here. And, you know, people say, oh, you're the speaker. You know, they think that's some kind of a special deal. You know, let me tell you, that's a form of service. It is a form of service to be able to do this, to be asked to do this. It might not be so bad if I just did it this weekend. But Sue and I go about 44 weekends out of the year. That's a commitment. That's a commitment. And I don't tell you that because I want you to think I'm kind of a special deal. I tell you that because I want you to know what a commitment is in our life. You don't hear people talk about these kind of things. You ask people to come and be a speaker and what have you. And in some places, they give you a big badge, so you really are pronounced as being some kind of a, you know, whip and jingle type dude. But Sue and I do it because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us we must, that we have no choice. And I do it because for a little over 13 years, I've been able to do these kind of things that are asked of me, and I haven't had to take a drink or do any drug. And I do it for no other reason. If it's because it's a kind gesture, why somebody else would be here? Because I'm not that kind of a person. This program has made me what I am today. It's given me a conscience. And it is a special thing to be able to, you know, have somebody meet you there. That is special, to have somebody who cares for you, you know, there. You sit in Chicago in the airport for 5 hours, well, I'll guarantee you, you want to meet somebody that's looking to see you. I'll guarantee you. We hadn't been there 15 minutes, and a Crip came up and wanted to sell me $2,000 worth of gold for $100, you know. I bought it, too. I said, hey, baby, stick with me. I'm going to give you presents. I know a deal when I can see it. She said, why do they always come to you, man? I said, it's you. I can spot a deal a long ways away. But anyway, I... you know, and I like to exercise. My timetable was off a little bit, so I ran last night. I walked around, and it helps me get adjusted to where I'm at. And I got up this morning, and I ran down the road a few miles, and you know, it was an unbelievable thing. I woke up, and I put on my clothes to go for a walk or jog or whatever, and I put on my shoes, and I went down, and I walked down the road, and I, you know, the scenery's beautiful, and I walked along the road, and people went by, and I looked at the houses and the beautiful green trees and things like that, and I'm going along there, and people pulled clear over on the other side of the road and went around me, you know, and I went by a garage sale up there, you know, somebody's having, I didn't have any money, I wanted to buy a shirt, looked like a hell of a deal there, and it was very serene and beautiful and comfortable. I mean, I really felt comfortable, and I came back and came up and got a cup of coffee and sat outside. Now, in Los Angeles, when I want to go for a jog, you got to put on a bulletproof vest. You got to put your rocket-generated shoes on, and you got to pay attention to what colors you're going to wear because you may go from one zone to the other. And a car may drive by at you all lowered down with boom boxes in the back and shooting AK-47s in your direction. So believe me, it was really nice to go for a little jog out here this morning. It was special. But so much for that. I'm comfortable, and that's what I'm trying to tell you. I'm comfortable, and that hasn't always been the way that it has been. I'm a real alcoholic, in case you want to know what one looks like. Well, there's a lot of things showing up nowadays, and I just want, you know, I want you to know what a real alcoholic looks like. Now, I don't say that to make any other alcoholic in the room wonder if they're a real alcoholic. But if you wonder, that's all right. But the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous defines a real alcoholic. And that, if there's one thing in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I identify with 110%, it's the definition of a real alcoholic. It defines a moderate drinker, a heavy drinker, and a real alcoholic. And it says a real alcoholic is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It says a real alcoholic, someone who's insanely drunk most of the time. It says a real alcoholic will use a little medication to enhance their drinking and their thinking. That means a real alcoholic use a little dope, too. Heaven forbid, but he will. So it defines it to a T. Defines it to a T. And so I'm a real alcoholic by that definition. I didn't look like I do today. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 6'2". I weighed about 230 pounds. I had long hair and a beard. I hadn't shaved. And about the only thing I had that would run was a beat-up old pickup truck and a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. And I'd been hiding for 100 days. I came out to die, really, you know. So, you know, I've changed. I was 3 years sober. I had to go down to the Department of Motor Vehicles and say, you know, my height really ain't 6'1 or 6'2 like I got it on here. I'm really 5'11. And the bloat has gone away. I'm down to about 180 now. So, but I'm grateful to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard my story when I was new, and maybe it'll pretty well describe the way I was. I used to drink a little beer and think maybe I ought to do something, and then I'd smoke a little weed and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. Then I'd shoot a little speed so I had the strength to do whatever I was going to do. And then I'd do a little coke so I could be cool when I did it, and then I'd drink a little whiskey and forget what the hell it was I was going to do. I I mean, I don't identify with anybody specialized. If you specialize, if the alcoholics in this room specialize or whatever, that's fine. I'm a pig myself. I'd do anything, anytime, anywhere. You know, I'd stick a horse turd in my right ear if I thought I'd get a fix off of it. And the people I drank with said I did that. So I... I'm glad I recognize. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My father's an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic, and that's as far as I wanted to check it out. You know, I mean, that's enough. And I don't blame them for me being an alcoholic. Certainly, I mean, if there's anything in my life today that has generated a willingness to stay sober, a desire to stay sober, a desire to survive, it has been the fact that I grew up in an alcoholic home. You grow up in an alcoholic home, and you survive. You take something. Take something special. It makes you a survivor. You grow up in an alcoholic home, you grow up with selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people. And if you survive out of that at all, and they don't lock you up in an institution, you have something going for you. Because the very place you're going to have to come, rooms like this, is full of selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, crazy people. And you're going to have to get along with them in order to, you know... And, you know, so I'm a survivor. My father's a lawyer, and I'm very grateful he went to the trouble to go to law school. I always needed a lawyer, so it was good that he did that. He's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He sobered up when he's 62 years old. I have 14 months of seniority on him, and I don't ever let him forget it. And I'm grateful for that. He's just my father. You know, all my life I wanted him to be. Well, we bumped our facades against each other for many years. He was anything but a father. He was a brother. He was a lawyer. He was a banker. You know, he was a crime partner at times. And you know, just a lot of those things that anything but truth. And the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about rigorous honesty. And I look for a lot of different areas to find the truth in that. And what I've, you know, come to understand is the truth that that's just my father. He's just my old man. That's all I ever wanted him to be, just my dad. And that's what he is today as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and him working the steps in his life and me working them in my life. He's just my old man. And our house is in order. We have a good relationship. He lives in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle. And that's where I was born and raised. Being born in Texas doesn't necessarily make you an alcoholic. It gives me certain characteristics, though, that I've always had. I've always had the ability to recognize your character defects and always had a need to tell you about them. And that made drinking a contact sport for me is what it did. I went a lot of places and did a lot of things. I'm a very active, insane, geographic type of an alcoholic. I did a lot of amphetamines, and that's like going 199 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor is what it is. I mean, you can just carry on long conversations with no one. I became a walking encyclopedia of worthless information is what I became, and I thought I was a book of knowledge, you know. I mean, just... insanity all the time, but I went a lot of places and did a lot of things. I attract things along the way. I have certain character defects that have caused me an awful lot of pain. One of them is you can line 10 women up against that wall over there, and I'll get the sickest one every time. I just love sick women. I mean, the sicker they are, the better they are. The insanity, I just love that thing. There's some in here, I can feel them. Yeah, they do. They set off a certain harmonic, you know, that just you just know they're ready, you know? I mean, God, I love it. I just love it. I'm just attracted to him. And, I mean, I just didn't have time to wait for somebody to pack, that's all. I mean, you got to be ready to go. And you got to be pretty sick to want to go along with a person like me. But I was standing along a little around a little country dance one Saturday night, not doing anything. When I don't do anything, something usually happens. Now, there's people who watch things happen and people who wait for things to happen. There's people who make things happen, and I'm one of those that makes things happen. I mean, wherever I go, something's happening because I'm there. You know, I just like it. I just like the excitement of it. I like the adrenaline. I like the deal. You know, I don't deal me in. 50 cents, 50 million. Deal me in. I want the action. You know, I just got out of jail. I'd been in jail for 18 months. They'd been studying my behavioral patterns, which they did periodically. I don't know why. It just drove them crazy, you know, but they wanted to study my behavioral patterns, and they had me locked up down in Texas for a few months there, and my previous wife had divorced me. Her father was one of the 10 richest men in the state of Texas, and he told me that he didn't get all his money making bad investments, and I was a bad investment, so they threw me away. I went to jail, and I'd just gotten out of jail, and the state of Texas had taken my driver's license away forever, and I didn't have a job, didn't have a car, didn't have nothing going for me. I went to this little country dance, and at midnight, while the band took a intermission, you know, and I looked around, and, you know, anybody had anything going for them was either going to fiddle, whittle, or diddle, and they were hauling cheeks, see, and I didn't have nothing. A bunch of hairy-legged old boys standing around. I took a coke ball, rolled it down to the end of the dance floor, and I said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring it back. It looked like a stampede coming my direction. And I hit the first guy leading the charge, because if he's stupid enough to lead the charge, I'll punch him, and then I split. And I'm not one of those people that stayed around and got my butt beat, I'll guarantee. I mean, I may be sick, but I'm not stupid. And I didn't lose a lot of fights because I didn't stay around until they were over. And I hit this guy and took off running. As I was going into a woman's restroom, there was a lady standing there, and that's where I was hiding. I'd run in and hide in the woman's restroom, and this lady standing at the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over, and I ran in, jumped up on a stool, locked the door, and pretty soon she came in, and she said, you can come out now, cowboy, and I said, okay. So I went out, and the band's playing, you know, and everything's, you know, going, and I said, you want to dance? I mean, she guarded the door, you know. I found out later she won the fight, but I didn't know that then, you know, but I, you know, and I, she said she wanted to dance, and so I'm a quick study. Don't take me long to find out what I need to know. One quick dance, man. Around that floor, I found out she had a job, she had a car, she had money in the bank, she had a place to stay, and I fell in love. I was never, ever going to fall in love ever again, you know, but I fell in love immediately right there because she had what I needed, and it was a Saturday night, and it was cold and dark and lonely. She took me home, and on the way home, we discussed our lives, you know. I mean, I wasn't really the prime example of the community, and she just got out of an unwed mother's home, you know. I mean, we didn't fall in love with each other. We kind of fell in sick with each other. You know, that's kind of where we deserve each other. Oh, man. I mean, that's sick, you know. And we went together for a couple of years because we didn't want to rush into anything. And she gave me an ultimatum. I mean, I don't know why sick women want to give you an ultimatum. Everything's just fine. Couple of years, I didn't have a job, I didn't have a car, I didn't have nothing going for me, and she wants to give me an ultimatum. I mean, she wanted me to marry her. I mean, after 2 years, I still didn't have a job, didn't have a car, didn't have nothing going for me, and she wants to get married. She says she's pregnant, and I'm the father. Now, I don't remember that. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says an alcoholic of my type will cross over an invisible line. I don't remember crossing over the invisible line, man. I was loaded when we made the trip, you know. If I'd have known it was going to be an important thing, I would have maybe had somebody documented. But I mean, and I don't remember getting her pregnant either. But I mean, at that time, my self-worth was so low, I said, well, you know, I'll go push the car around the block. If you don't miscarriage, well, I'll marry you. I mean, I don't know. A friend of mine said that. I know it. But she was healthy. You know, all of a sudden I found myself with a wife and a kid and a dog and a cat. You know, I mean, you got to get these things. Periodically, people want us to look, you know, like act or whatever, you know, simulate what's going on across the street or in the community, whatever. I don't know. I don't like responsibility. I don't know anything about responsibility. I don't know anything about working. I'm a thief. You know, I mean, God knows I'm a thief. I know I'm a thief. Now you know I'm a thief. I don't like to work. Mundane effort. I like the excitement. I don't even have guilt until I get caught. I mean, it's just great. And all of a sudden, I find myself with this woman and this kid and, you know, a dog. I go over to your house to get a dog out of the litter. I'll get the craziest one every time. I got a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated me. I took him to obedience class, and we both got 86th out of obedience class for being violent. You know, I mean, it's just... I can go to your house to get an Easter bunny for the kid for Easter, and I get the one with ringworm. You know what I mean? I just, there's some insanity about that. And I got a cat, you know, I got this kid a cat, and one morning hungover, they sent me down to the vet to get the cat neutered or something. I don't know what they did, but it made him mad, I know that. Should have got that sucker declawed because he hated me. He was always, I shot at him at least a dozen times over the course of the next 8 years and never could kill him. He's always attacking me. And eventually I had to leave Texas. That'll happen to you if you stay there doing what I was doing long enough. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they call those trips geographic. In Texas, they call it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. We loaded up this car and this trailer, and we got the dog and the cat and the kid in there, you know, and I'm loaded, and we're going to go to California. You know, a guy gave me a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach. I didn't have sense enough to know that's ocean, you know. I worked in the oil fields when I worked, you know, and I hung around with people that said, if you get in jail, we'll get you out, and if we can't get you out, we'll get in there with you. You know, I mean, they just crazy, and we loaded up and we started for California. Now, from where I lived, I left Oklahoma City, and it took 30 days to get to Los Angeles. Most people can do it in three, you know, but I mean, it was just insane. You know, I had this old station wagon, and the dog would run back and forth over the cat, and they'd fight, and the kid would be in the middle of it, and she'd be crazy, and I'd drink, you know. And when we got to California, I got arrested. I got arrested because somewhere in the trip, I knocked the mirror off the right side of the car. And I had this trailer on the back, and, you know, I mean, it's her job to look out that side. The mirror's gone. That's her job. I mean, what are they for, anyway? I mean, besides their Social Security number, I mean, they got to help you out when you need help. And she's hanging out that side of the car, and the cops in California said, we don't have human rearview mirrors in California. But the important thing is, everywhere I went, it took me, and just as soon as I got there, I got arrested. You know, I finally found a place where I could take up residency. I got a drunken uncle, and he, you know, set me up in a house nobody lived in for a while, and it was just right. The deal was the best deal around, and I moved in there. And, you know, I'm just like flypaper, you know, bam, I'm right there. I moved into a neighborhood where there's a bunch of people, weird people living on one side of me. They were AWOL from the Marine Corps, and they were taking LSD and laying in the front yard watching the sun come up and go down. Going blind. I'd never seen anything like that in Texas. I mean, intriguing. And motorcycle gang on the other side, just crazy. I mean, I left Texas to get away from those people, and I moved right in next to them. I mean, that's where I was. I was comfortable there. That's what it was. I was there. And I set up residency. I didn't move my family a whole lot. I went places and did things, and I come home because I was tired. You got to go home to rest. That's the only reason you go home. You go home to rest. And I always had all my friends with me. You know, they're the ones that don't want to go home to their old lady. So they come over to your house to watch the fight, you know. And then we get over there, and there she'd be. And she'd be yelling and screaming. And the kid would be bawling. The dog would be barking. The cat would be scratching me, you know. And I'm trying to say, Daddy's home, for Christ. You know, I got all my friends, you know. Then this lady I live with started carrying a 12-inch butcher knife, waving it around all the time, you know. And my buddies are saying, get her, you know. And I, you get her, man, you know. Crazy as a loon in there. Set up pots and pans inside the door so we couldn't sneak up on her, you know. I mean, you could usually hear us coming for two blocks. I don't know why she had to put the pans in there, but I'd step one of them pans. I always wore boots, kept my gun in my boot. I'd step one of them pans and turn the toe of my boot up and clamp her down. I couldn't get my gun out of my boot to defend myself, and she'd be waving the butcher knife around, you know, and it's just insane. One time I got my gun and I stuck it right in her mouth. I said, if you don't shut up, I'm going to kill you. And she said, go ahead. I said, you're crazy. If I shoot you, you'll die. And she said, I know, but when you shoot me, I'll go backwards and the knife will go forwards. And I'll, you know. I knew you'd understand that. You know, samurai warriors train all their life to get the last kill, but a pre-Al-Anon knows that intuitively. I mean, we finally get everything calmed down, you know, and then, you know, everybody lay down for a little while, and then right up, because I always woke up quick. I got to get my heart started, go out in the kitchen, put about 100 mini bennies in the blender, some orange juice, couple of raw eggs, a little something to get your motor going, pour a big glass of vodka, hit it a couple of times, some Tabasco sauce, pound those two down, and I always had an intuitive thought. I thought, I think I'll mow my front yard. I didn't have a front yard, I had front dirt. I like to mow front dirt, you don't need a grass catcher. I go out in the garage, try to find my lawnmower. It's out there somewhere under everything, you know, and I, 5 o'clock in the morning, get my mower going out in the front yard and just drive my neighbors across the street insane because they had all the dichondra and everything, you know. They'd just be out there going insane, and I'd be slinging dandelions and weeds everywhere over there. One morning, my mower died. I don't know. I didn't have a very good maintenance program on my stuff. I figured, well, you know, the guarantee's up, so we'll just bury it right here. So I shot my mower with a 44 mag in the morning. I was planning the funeral, and the cops come, and they want to run my head into their nightstick 5 or 6 times. And then she comes out and tells them, don't take him away. We got lots of stools clogged. You got to do all this stuff, you know. And she goes nuts, and then they put handcuffs on her somewhere in the course of the thing. And I say, now you got the right one, you know. I mean, this crazy woman running around here, for Christ's sake, you know. And then some cop says something derogatory about my wife, and I have to hit him because nobody talks bad about my wife except me. Then it takes the handcuffs off her and put them on me, and she can run around and say, now you got it right. Then they take me down to jail, and she can come down and write a hot check and get me out so I can come home and start it all over again, you know. I come home, and, you know, what goes up's got to come down. I get a little depressed, and I'd lay down in my old rocker. I had an old recliner in the living room in there, kind of broken just right, and I'd drink a little Red Mountain wine. Her and the kid and the dog and the cat would line up over on their line of contempt, you know. I had an old Winchester 97 shotgun my grandpappy gave me, and I'd get it out, and I'd stick the barrel in my mouth and click the trigger. It was empty, of course, because I wasn't going to commit suicide till the crowd got there, you know. One day I jacked it back, and I seen something red go by. I thought, I wonder what that was. I pulled that gun over there and clicked the trigger. That bitch put a shell in that gun. Blew the air conditioner right out of the window. I couldn't hear out of that ear for 3 weeks, I think. We had a hell of a fight, and the cops come, want to run my head into their nightstick 5 or 6 times out there, you know. Then they come with the van. They always sent 3 cops to my house. They get the van over there with I Love Me Not sports coat, you know, and put you in one of them straight jackets out in the front yard and take you down there and talk to you about your mother, and then you can talk to them about their mother. And then they observe you for another 72 hours, you know. They had me laying on one of them tables one time. I was yelling, screaming. I thought, I wonder why I'm screaming. So I quit screaming. I listened. Hell, everybody else who was tied down was screaming. I didn't want to be different, you know. One time I had this. I'd been in the nut ward so many times, they'd give me a little card that said I was crazy, you know. I'd come back and stick it in the slot anytime I wanted. Now, I never did that knowingly or willingly. There ain't no doorknobs on the inside of them doors. But it impressed my friends. I was in there one time, and I was thinking, I got to get something going here. I got to tell these people something. I know what it was. I was in the big war. I was in the paratroopers, and they took me up in this airplane, I don't know, 15, 20,000 feet, and I got this big pack on my back, and I'm flying. I don't know how we're up 15, 20,000 feet in the air, and all of a sudden it's time to jump, and everybody's jumping out of that deal, and I'm thinking, man, I got to jump, and I froze right in the door, and they shoved me out of the door, and I fell 15, 20,000 feet. My chute didn't open. My landing tree flung me over there and lit on my head. I laid there a long time. People come and got me, took me over here, and they put me over there, and then they took me to this hospital, and they gave me these little pills, and when I take these little pills and drink whiskey, I go crazy. And this psychiatrist said, just a minute. He went out of that room, went and called my wife up. He said, I think he's in the wrong hospital. He should be over at the VA hospital. And she said, what the hell for? He's never been in the service. You know, just when I had a good story, she wouldn't go along with it. They let me out of there, and I'd have to go back home. You know, I'd get back home, make the great escape, get out of there. I'd get over there and watch. Well, her car's the only thing that's running, and her money and her keys are in there, you know, and by the door, you know, and I'd run and grab her purse and scoop it up and run out and get in the car and start it up and throw it in reverse, back down the driveway, look back, be sure nobody's behind me, and turn around. There she'd be on the hood, beating on the window. I don't know if there's any hood riders in here or not, but that'll sober an old drunk quick, man. You got back up the driveway, drag her off the hood, the dog's biting in the ass, the cat's scratching, the kid's bawling, you're having a big fight out there, you know, in the front yard. The dope fiends next door, they come out, the cops come, and the dope fiends call the cops pigs. I said, don't do that when they're beating on me, man. I don't do that to you, you know. And that's kind of the way it was when I was a social drinker. Well, I mean, I don't identify with any social drinking. Other than that, I'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous prior to that. I mean, I was 30 years old. I'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day I found myself standing in front of a judge, and he's talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy, you know, and he's talking to me about violating my parole, and he's saying, you know, you got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll let you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll, you know, show you where a meeting is and this and that and the other. And, you know, I didn't know what to say. I'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been to jail, and, you know, I knew, you know, if you don't know nothing about something, why then, you know, you have nothing to be afraid of. So he was talking to me about going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he set it all up, and I said, okay. And she'd been to the lawyer that afternoon again and again and again and again, and he said maybe I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I got home from the court, why, she said, you know, she'd been to the lawyer, and he said I should go to AA, and I'm thinking, well, my judge said, and parole officer said I should go to AA, and so I said, well, you got a smart lawyer, you know, I mean, what can you say? I laid down, and I told her, I said, the meeting starts at 8:30, and it's over at 10, and it's down here at the church, and pretty soon, you know, she come over there at 8 o'clock and punched me right on the shoulder and stuck this butcher knife in my face and said, get up. I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to that A&A meeting. I said, I don't know if I want to go. She said, you're going. They'd taken all my guns away. I couldn't defend myself. So I got up and went over and got in the car, and we went down the road to that church, and we pulled up out in front of that church out there, and she said, what time's the meeting start? I said, 8:30. She said, what time's it over? 10 o'clock. So I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door 410, I'm going to gut you. You can keep a guy like me in a room like this if you got a crazy woman circling the perimeter. I passed out on her one time 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation, and she stabbed me 100 and some times in the back and then poured rub and alcohol on me. So I know about that. So I said, okay, I went in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were in there talking about going to a lot of meetings, getting a sponsor, working the steps. I know that, you know. But I wasn't really, really an alcoholic. And if you're not really an alcoholic, you're not really an alcoholic. See, there's two kinds of people come to this program, been my observation. There's the kind of people who come here to change the circumstances in their life, and there's the people who come here to change their life. And I was there to change the circumstances in my life. That's all. And I sat in one meeting a week for 4 months. An amazing thing happened to me. She waited right outside that door, man. One night a week, she kept me in there. My most miserable time of my entire life. She was happy as heck. But amazing thing happened to me going to one meeting a week. My life changed. The first step was wrong. It said it was powerless over alcohol. I knew that. My next door neighbor said, you're powerless over alcohol. You drink whiskey, you go crazy. We got some tie sticks come in. If you smoke these tie sticks, well, you won't go crazy. I said, what do you do when you smoke tie sticks? So we sit around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I said, I don't wait for no ice cream truck. I rob ice cream trucks. What are you talking about? He said, well, you know, you just try it. But, you know, I mean, there was a reservation there. I didn't do that, but they were telling me, you don't, and I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm thinking to myself, self, you've been too hard on yourself. I mean, I know I'll be in AA someday, maybe, but I'll be old. I mean, I looked around, you know, I mean, the old dog sitting next to me, pat him on the head, you know, he's smiling at me. The cat's in my lap purring, the kid's over here, pat the kid on the head. You know, I beat the deal down at the courthouse. You know, I'm back in the big bedroom. And I thought, you know, hey, no problem. And I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. Amazing thing happened to me when I resigned from Alcoholics. I got struck drunk almost immediately. Almost immediately, and I'll guarantee you, my life changed. My life changed. The next 4 years of my life, there's nothing cute or funny about my life, because there's nothing worse than being out there having a belly full of booze, arm full of dope, and head full of AA. God, it makes you angry. You know? Oh, it's terrible. My helper here. In the next 4 years of my life, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of things happened to me. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says we're supposed to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. A lot of people don't, seems to me, and I only have what I got to share, my experience, strength, and hope. If I don't share with you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today, I have no experience, strength, and hope. And a lot of people seem to want to talk about what it used to be like and then switch right into how wonderful it is today. That's not my story. I have a great, great reference point in my life because, you see, I'm the kind of an alcoholic. I'm an egotist. I have the kind of an alcoholic personality that the big book talks about, a great ego. That ego must be surrendered over and over and over and over and over again, even in sobriety. But it has to get to a point of surrender to come here and do these things. Because you see, to do the things that this program asks of you is against the nature of my very being. Because, and it says that in the next to last paragraph of the step number one in the 12 and 12. It says this is, you have to hit a bottom. This is against the nature. Because it says you have to admit that you're insane and you can be restored to sanity. And I always said you can't be restored to something you never have anymore. You can come back to some place you've never been. It says you've got to come to believe in a power greater than yourself and make a decision, turn your will and your life over to a power greater than yourself we call God. Now, I come from the Baptist Bible Belt down there in Texas, and I've been prayed on, prayed over, sprinkled, dipped, screwed, blued, and tattooed, and it didn't work for me, you know. You know, I didn't have no belief in that. And then it says you got to put this stuff on paper, sign it, and go tell somebody. My lawyers have told me forever, don't ever put that on paper. You'll be put away for the rest of your life. And then character defects, it talks about character defects. If I didn't have character defects, I wouldn't be nothing. And then it talks about amends. Hey, if you have anything to do with me, you got to be a little bit wrong. You know, I mean, you just do. If you're 1% wrong and I'm 99% wrong, wrong is wrong. So why do I got to make amends to you? I mean, you knew what you was dealing with when you came in. So you just deal with it. And then it says you got to look at yourself every day and promptly admit when you're wrong. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous said men and women drink for the effect. The effect is after a certain amount of consumption, you can't distinguish the difference between true and false, right or wrong. That's the definition of a sociopath. I ain't got no conscience. Look at myself. I did thousands of dollars worth of alcohol and narcotics to keep from looking at me. And then pray and meditate. I had already tried to pray, and every time I meditated, I slipped into a sexual fantasy. I don't know what I was doing, you know. And then it says the stupidest thing of all in the 12th step for a drinking drunk, give it away. I don't want to give nothing away. Nothing. So you see, you got to get to some point. You have to get to some point beyond where you can go by yourself. And that's exactly what the what happened was for me. I had to get to that point. I'm the type of an alcoholic, as long as there's one man, woman, child, dog, or cat that'll roll over when I snap my fingers, I won't do nothing about me. If there's any more enablers left, I'll roll right over you. If there's anybody else going to come along and pick me up and pat me on the poo-poo, get me out of jail, fix me one more time, I'm still rolling out there. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd run out of friends and enemies at the same time. I had no drinking buddies. There was nobody left. And what it took for me to get to that point was about 4 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out of the business of living. And I did a lot of things and went a lot of places. I'm a violent drunk, physically violent. I won't debate with anybody whether verbal abuse is worse than physical violence. But I will tell you, I was talking to you when I was beating the shit out of you, too. I was letting you know. And what I was saying was, you ain't nothing. You're never going to be nothing. You're nothing. Because you see, we attract the things we fear the most. Alcoholics of my type. We attract the things we fear the most. We destroy everything around us. If my daughter tells me she loves me, she has to die. Don't you understand that? It has to be eliminated to prove it's wrong. To prove I'm right. That's just the way it is. We have no choice. The things that I know that hurt me the most is like standing in my kitchen one morning, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. I look down the hallway, and a little 9-year-old girl stands at the end of that hallway, and I'm taking a hit off a bottle of vodka. And when I look down at the end of that hallway, she's looking at me. She's got her chin on her chest, and her hair's in her face, and she's got an old coat on that she wore all the time to bed and everywhere, and she had an old rotten egg and rolled around in that lining about that time of the year, a little after Easter, and she'd sit on that egg and she looked and smelled like she looked and smelled. She had no friends. She looked like a scared animal. She was a wounded animal. She hid back in the back of that room. And she looked down that hallway at me many, many mornings, but one morning in particular that I remember, I looked down the hallway and she's looking at me and I'm looking at her, and she didn't run down the hallway and grab me around the leg and say, "Daddy, come play with me today." She didn't even say, "Daddy, please don't beat me and Mommy." She looked at me and I looked at her, and I turned around and I took a drink out of that bottle. And when I looked back, she was gone. Because the only thing she wanted to know is what direction I was going so she'd go the other way. Or maybe one morning, I don't know what time it was, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'd look down around where I'm standing is in a bathroom in my own home, and there's a hole in the door in that bathroom, and that door's closed, but you can look out. And when I turned around, I looked in the mirror, and what I just got through doing was cooking up some of that dope in a spoon, and I was putting it in that syringe because, you see, the booze had quit working, and I reached for something else. Something else has got to turn it off. Something else has got to stop this thing. Something else has got to turn this thing off because, you see, it just can't keep going on like this. I can't stand myself, and I'll reach for anything. And when I'm standing there getting ready to stick that needle in my arm, I look back around, and when I look in that mirror, a little 9.5, 10-year-old girl's looking through the hole in that door, and just for a second my eyes catch her, and I look at her, and she didn't say, "Daddy, what are you doing? Please don't beat me and mommy today." She looked at me for a second, and I turned back around, and I did what I had to do. I had no choice. When I looked back in that mirror, she was gone, because the only thing she wanted to know is which direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. And when I looked in that mirror, I knew I was just what I thought I was. I'm me. There ain't no way to stop this thing. You can't stop this thing. I don't have it. It's got me. And it doesn't make any difference what goes on in my life. It doesn't make any difference what goes on in their life. It's just the way it is. There's no change in this thing. It only gets worse. And the sooner it gets worse, the better it is. And then that stuff would kick in and work a little bit. For a little while. A little while. And then I could go out and do it again. I could start it all over again. Because that's the way it is in an alcoholic home. You don't have no choice. The people in there have no choice. There isn't anybody coming into that kind of an environment saying, "Come go with me." Because the people don't come into that environment. You know, you can take everything away from a human being, and they'll still be a human being. Except when you lose your dignity. Money, property, prestige, people, places, and things. They can all go. But when you lose your dignity, you got nothing left to lose. And you're as near an animal as a human being can be. I robbed those people of their dignity. Not me personally, but the disease. Because on any given moment, because I'm the type of an alcoholic that it describes in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are times when it seems that I'm loving and caring. And I talk about a spiritual way of life. I'll tell you about a Sunday morning whenever I was full of guilt and remorse, when my medicine wasn't working. Whenever we went over and sat in that church house, and my wife sat on one side of me and my daughter sat on the other side of me, and we prayed, they prayed, and we went down the aisle, and we came back up that aisle wet, and we did all these things. And then I walked outside that church house and reached under the front seat of my pickup truck and got a bottle of hot vodka and took a pull off of it and turned around and gave those people sign language. You know what that did? That robbed my wife and my daughter of the belief in a power greater than themselves. That robbed them in a belief of God, because everybody was sitting in that church praying that I didn't drink. And I proved it won't work. I destroyed that belief. I stole their soul. And all the while I'm standing there saying I'm hurting nobody but myself. Because I am the alcoholic. I am the alcoholic. When that disease takes over, we have no choices. There's nothing left. And I lived that way not one day, not one week, but years. For years. And then one day. And then one day, I couldn't stand me any longer. And then one day, these people couldn't stand me any longer, and they couldn't stand themselves. And one day, they walked away. And I had to look at me. And I didn't want to look at me. You know, if I could have got that much relief from any kind of a narcotic, somebody else would be standing here. But it wouldn't work no more. They got out of the way. They took their God suits off, and they got out of the way, and they let God and booze do what no human power can do. They surrendered me, and I asked for help. I asked for help one more time. The only difference is I asked for help with no conditions, absolutely none. I believe my willingness to do what I got to do today to stay sober is directly proportional to what I had to do to get here. I know most of the alcoholics, even meetings where I go that's predominantly alcoholics, don't even identify with the way I drank. Most of the people in these meetings like this identify with the victims. That doesn't make any difference. You identify with the feeling of hopelessness, of bewilderment, the loneliness, the damnable loneliness. the insanity of no choice, the umbrella of anger, the umbrella of fear. I know fear. Fear's been my partner all my life. I drive fear like a fast car. And I put that umbrella over everybody around me until they escape. And one day, I called an alcoholic. It took some time, took some effort. But you see, those years that I was going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous were not in vain. I knew there was an answer. The seed was planted, and when it was time, I reached out. And because Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works good, a little gray-headed man showed up in my house. And he believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't meet him at the front door and say, "Gee, I'm glad to see you. I want a cup of that rotten coffee and a red jelly donut." I was nuts. And he come to the front door. I stuck a .357 Magnum right in his face. And I said, "You take me back to the nut ward, I'll kill you and everybody else around here." And he did something he's never done before since. Took the gun out of my hand, threw it on the couch. And he said, "Now we got a crowd. If you want to go ahead and kill yourself, go ahead." He said, "But if you don't want to drink again, you don't have to. If you don't want to be lonely again, you don't have to." And I didn't know how you could go 15 seconds without having some kind of chemical in, but when he said, "You don't have to be lonely again," I wanted that. The loneliness was destroying me because I wasn't dying fast enough. And I believed him, and I followed him. He took me, and he put me in a place where they helped me, where people in Alcoholics Anonymous came. And I was in there for a little over a month, locked up in this place, and they helped me because they believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they brought people in there from Alcoholics Anonymous, people who believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. They spent some time that night. They took me and locked me up. They talked to my wife and my daughter. People from Alcoholics Anonymous carried the message of Al-Anon to an insane lady and a beat-up little girl. And they told them, "I got to take care of me. And they got to do something about themselves." People from Alcoholics Anonymous carried that message. And of Alcoholics Anonymous every day, as long as I drank, I said I drank at least 22 years. They said, "You have to go to a meeting every day for 22 years before you can have a night off and go to a movie." They said I was going to have to work these steps. I was going to have to get a sponsor. I was going to have to do all these things. I didn't know what to do. I don't know what to do. They assigned me a sponsor. A guy by the name of Rotten Ron. Crazy, crazy. I mean, he come from the hard-hearted sponsor school. Rotten, rotten. Oh, no mercy whatsoever. No pity, nothing. They said, "You need a sponsor so an idiot won't be running your life." You know? They weren't nice to me. I said, "I don't like this God thing." They said, "The only one thing you got to know about God, there is one and you ain't him." You know? Yeah. It's that simple. They told me to go home and keep my mouth shut. Give me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They took me over to the house, dropped me off. I run up and knocked on the front door. She came to the front door and I said, "I got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do, bitch?" You know. She said, "Oh, I've been going to Al-Anon. The kids have been going to Alateen. The dog's been going to Ally Dog. And the cat's been going to Ally Cat. And what are you going to do?" You know, I didn't know what to do. I went and called my sponsor. He said, "Don't do nothing, just shut up." And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And she started going to one meeting a week. I'm going to tell you something. It's been my observation. Anything I share here with you is just my observation, my experience. But I've been very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my home is a program home. Now, you can tell when an alcoholic has been to Alcoholics Anonymous for a while. You live with a slipper or with a drunk, you can tell when he's sober. And you can tell when he's had a slip. We can tell when you're not doing anything, too. We can. I can tell the difference between sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and going in a bar. I can't come home to an old idea and stay sober. There's a difference between being around Al-Anon and being in Al-Anon. A big difference. And we see that. We sober up. You know, one of my pet peeves is for people to make fun of Al-Anon. I get angry because we've seen them die through and on. You better believe it. Sue and I have seen them die. This is a fatal disease. We've had them come to our home and reach for this thing and go back out there and die.
We've had him come to our home and go back out there and say, no, I don't need this. It's him. You know, he's sober. It's all going to be fine. And then she agitates the gardener until he stabs her 8 times in the chest in the front yard. And it goes down to some... The gardener don't even know what the hell happened. But we do. Because we know what happened. Her insanity and her need to control drove that person to a point of insanity where they had to kill the very thing that was attacking them. We've seen that. So I believe in the program. I believe in these steps. I believe everybody that's affected by it needs it. And I'm very grateful that it has applied in our home. But I didn't just come right in and start doing it. I started going to these meetings. I owed a lot of money when I sobered up. I owed over $250,000, and I owed it to people that you don't write them a letter and say, I'm going to send you a dollar, Ace. I'll guarantee you. I had people after me. And I had things to do, business to take care of. The book talks about waves of the past rolling over you. And Sue knew about that. My daughter knew about these things. And they let me go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she started going to Al-Anon. And it wasn't easy. I went home one night, come home from a meeting. I'd been sober a few days or something there, a month or two, and a dog come around there, and somebody passed gas, and they blamed me and come around there and sprayed Lysol all over me. And I jumped up. I'm sober 54 days. I threw a can of Lysol through the window and run outside and got it and threw it back in. And we all just stopped and look, my God, he's got a temper. He's sober. You better believe it. My anger sober is like looking through a straw. I mean, I see it. I got to deal with that. Don't just go away. I have to turn this into energy to be able to work a program. And I started going to meetings all the time. They told me I had to go to work. I had to pay these amends back. And, you know, the good thing about Sue and Simone working a program is they left me alone. They didn't come and give me a bunch of crap about the money I'm having to pay these debts with and them being deprived. I mean, the gratitude was I was physically sober. They left me alone. I only slept in my home 61 times in the first 3 years I was sober. That saved our marriage, by the way. I mean, we're talking about a physically violent environment. When you sober up, all of a sudden you ain't just wonderful. That's one of the big illusions around here. An alcoholic can sober up and he cleans up. Man, there's nothing prettier than an alcoholic woman sober up. The cheeks get rosy. Everything. An old Al-Anon comes in here, man, they're beat all to hell. It's about a year before they hit a bottom after being around here, and about two before they start getting the sparkle in their eye. It takes time. They've been beat down sober. And I had to, you know, leave them alone. Leave him alone. Let that kid go out to you. I'll tell you what I did, and I have another opinion I want to share with you. I have a strong feeling about people who come to AA and Al-Anon and don't bring their kids to Alateen. I have a strong... How can you be so selfish to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or a meeting of Al-Anon and get what's here, the beautiful life that's here, and deprive your children of that and say, I'm growing spiritually? I hear it all the time. That's selfish. Oh, I don't want to make my kids come here. I've punished them enough. My God, what are you talking about? You don't want them to come here and get a way of life? That's selfish. I made my kids go to Alateen. I said, I got to go to AA, you got to go to Alateen. She hated me for a year and a half. She did. I gave her permission to hate me for a year and a half. That's hard. I remember one day, I was sober a little while. We get a conscience. We sober up. We remember. Us alkies, I may have destroyed a lot of brain cells, but I can remember. My memory comes back. And I come home and she was doing something. I don't know, taking clarinet lessons, and she quit going to the clarinet lessons. She didn't want to play a clarinet. She wanted to go over there with the boys' basketball team and keep score. And so she was telling me she was going to do this and that and the other. And I said, well, you got clarinet lessons. She said, well, I'll call a teacher and set it up for another day. So I said, okay. So she went in and made a couple of phone calls and said, will you take me back to school? And I said, did you change your clarinet lessons thing? She said, oh, yeah, I took care of it. I called a teacher. And I said, okay. So I took her to school. And, you know, I'm sober a little while. And she's starting to shape up, going to 2 or 3 Alateen meetings, you know. And we're going over there to school. And I'm going to drop her off. And she's excited because, my kid was so beat down that, you know, went a year or so into the program while she started coming back around, you know, and you know, she was becoming a woman. And so she was excited about going over there and keeping score for the boys' basketball team. And I was too, and I dropped her off, and I go back home and the phone rings. And it's a clarinet teacher. She said, "Where's Simone?" I said, "I don't know. Didn't she call you?" She said, "No. As a matter of fact, you owe me $45. She's missed the last three times, including today." And I said, "I'll tell you what, lady, I'll pay you. Don't you worry. Don't worry. And she won't be back." So that night when Simone came home, I'm sober a little while, and I said, "You lied to me, baby. You lied to me." She said, "Well, I called the teacher, but nobody was there." And I said, "No, you lied to me. You know what we're talking about here, and it's Tuesday, and you're not going anywhere except to school. We're gonna have a little punishment thing here, but I'm gonna be here to be sure. You're gonna come home from school, and I'm gonna be here. I'm gonna come home, and we're gonna stay home together. You can't go anywhere for a week. I won't assess any punishment that we can't both live with. But here it is. This is the way it is. I'm sober. I got a memory." And she cried all night. The next morning, she said, "Daddy, take me to school." And I got up the next morning. Okay. We got in that car, and she's on her way to school. She pushed my buttons. She said, "Daddy, I don't want to go in that schoolhouse and tell the coach that I can't keep score for those guys that I've been punished, that I lied." I said, "I know it's going to be hard, but you're going to do it." She said, "You know, Daddy, they got a lot of drugs in that school. I can buy all kinds of stuff in there." And I said, "Yeah." And something screamed 2 inches behind my belly button, "God, don't do this to me. Don't do this to me. I'm trying to be the best father I know how. I'm doing my best. I ain't real good." And she said, "You know, I feel like if I go in there and get some of that drug, some of that stuff in me, it won't be so hard for me to tell them that I've been punished." And I said, "Maybe so." And about that time, I pulled up in front of that schoolhouse, and I said, "Baby, I'm going to tell you something." Because I'd prayed to my God, and I asked my God to give me the words to say to my own daughter. I said, "Baby, I'm going to tell you something. I love you more than anything in the world. And God knows I've beat you, and I've punished you, and I've deprived you of a lot of things. And if you got to walk in that schoolhouse and go in there and get you some of that dope and stick it in you in order to go through the emotions and feelings that you got to go through, because I'm telling you, you're going to stick with this deal, then you're going to have to walk in there, and I ain't going with you. I'm not going in there with you. If you got to go in there, you go in there and you do it. Because I'm not backing down, but I want you to know I love you more than anything to face this earth. But for 1 second, by God, reflect on where it took me. And if you got to go down that road, sweetheart, I'll love you all the way. But if our past is worth nothing, it's worth 1 second of reflection." And she kissed me and got out of that car. And she made that journey, and she didn't have to stop and pick up no dope. And I rode back home, and I prayed to this God I don't know nothing about, because every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. And I had to go through that wall of fear. You know, today that little girl stands tall. She's 26 years old. She's a professional model. She stands tall. She's got a sparkle in her life. She's been able to walk beyond where other people have feared to go. And you say you don't want to punish your kid by taking them to Alateen. Bullshit. You can't deprive them of that and say you work a program. I gave her permission to hate me for a year and a half so she can love me for 11 and a half beyond anything I ever experienced. And she called me 1 o'clock in the morning before we left from Italy. And she said, "Daddy, I love you." She's got a good life. A good life. She knows we do too. You see, that's what the program has given us. Our program has brought us together. We're not attached at the hip. It has given us a way of life to practice these principles in all of our life, to live a way of life. You know, people tell Sue and I, you know, that we have no life because we don't spend that much time together. I'm going to tell you, we have a life today that is quality because our life is devoted to this. We've been through things. It's been hard. It's been hard. I've gone through lots of surrenders because I'm the type of an alcoholic that ego comes up. And I put my gods as money, property, and prestige in sobriety. And I've paid some big prices, some big surrenders. We've been big deals around the program. We've been big wheels around the program. And we've had all the babies and all the big chairman deals and all that stuff. And we've had it taken away because our motives were wrong. But because we had a good foundation here, we didn't have to run away. And we found that a lot of people came into our lives and asked us to be their sponsor and do things because they wanted our approval. And we found that we don't have to crawl before anyone. The book tells me, I crawl before no one. I answer to my God. And it's not hard. I mean, it's hard. It's not easy. But we've been able to make this a way of life. You know, I love that lady more than anything on the world, in the face of this world. I love her. You know why I love her? Because she's never resented the method of my recovery. She has always supported my sobriety, which has to come first. Physical sobriety has to come first for the alcoholic. And so being, I have supported her sanity. I have given her the freedom to do what she has to do, to have a sponsor, to go to a lot of meetings, to be active, to do those things. And I've supported her program. I've made my amends. Our house is in order. It's not been easy. But it's been the greatest thing that I know. You know how I can tell you that I love her? I've been faithful to her for over 13 years. You see, those are the simple little things that I base my sanity and my love on. Not a bunch of words or a bunch of actions for which I've been given the strength to do, to devote my life to this. We've been through a lot of things in sobriety, a lot of things. Menopause, even. I had to go to an old-time alcoholic guy, and he says, you know, it didn't just her, you're changing too. Not me, not the mortal man. You know, those things. You know what my sponsor told me when we were going through that? He said, you pray every morning to not commit adultery. And you pray every night to thank God for not doing it. And you follow that. I did that for days because I wanted to run away. And you know what that did? That brought us together. It brought us closer together. She's my wife. She's my lover. She's my very best friend. And she's not my sponsor. And I'm grateful for that. You know, when I was new, I heard a story about a little boy that lived on a farm, and I want to share it with you. I grew up on a farm in the Texas Panhandle, and the story goes, a little boy was standing out on his farm with his daddy one day, and a man come down the road in a big black Buick, I suppose, in a big car, and he pulled up into this farm, and he looked around, and a man got out, and he came over and talked to the farmer for a little while, and there was a big barn along the side of the road where this farm was, and the little boy watching the man in the big car gave the farmer a few bucks, and talked, and they walked down and looked at the side of this barn, and the guy pulled a big Buick down there by the side of the barn and opened the trunk up, and pretty soon he started putting this poster up on the side of this barn because the road went by. Little boy stood there and he watched this man put this poster up on the side of the barn. He'd never seen anything like it in his entire life. He'd lived on that farm all of his life. And when the poster was full bloom on the side of that barn, what it was a picture of a circus that was coming to town. And the little boy had never seen anything like that. He lived on a farm all his life. And he looked there, and there was all the beautiful people and all their beautiful costumes. And there was all the animals in the circus. And he'd seen animals around the farm all his life. And he'd never seen anything like that in his entire life. And he went to his daddy and he said, Daddy, can I go see the circus when it comes? And being a good father, the father said, yeah, son, if you're a good boy, work real hard. When the circus comes to town, I'll let you go. And the little boy went down and looked at that poster every day, and he couldn't believe it. He'd stand there and on. He'd just visualize how it was going to be to see this thing. And come the day for the circus to come to town, while the little boy got the 50 cents from his daddy, and he went 5 miles into town. And as he got to the edge of town, there it was. There was a circus. It had come in on the train, and he had the big top down at the other end of town. And they were making a parade down through the center of town like a circus used to do. And the little boy sat down on the curb, and he watched this parade. There they were, all the beautiful people and all the beautiful animals and living life. Color, and he was just amazed at this, and he sat right there on the curb, and as this circus went by, the last person in the parade was a clown, and when the clown went by the little boy, the clown tipped his hat. The little boy flipped his 50-cent piece up into the clown's hat, and he got up and he walked 5 miles back home. When he got home, his daddy said, son, did you see the circus? And the little boy said, yeah, daddy, I saw the circus. That's a sad story. You know that? That's not a happy story, because he didn't see the circus. He saw the passing parade. See, this is a passing parade. The circus is in the big top. I don't want to be a sad story. I've been a sad story all my life. I want to be in the big top where there's living, loving, action, life, enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is God within. I don't want to sit on the curb and watch it go by. I've been there. I've been there. I want this deal. For me, it's in that big book. In those steps. Change. I'm afraid of change. God, I don't want to change. But I'm willing to change because my life has got better. My life has got better. full of life, full of happiness. I get to have some pain, but I don't live in it. And the people around me get to have some happiness because they don't live in pain. There was a little cobbler man who died and he went to heaven as he was standing in front of God. God told him, you know, you've been a good man all your life. Good man, you worked hard and you gave everything you had to your family. And the only one thing was that you never really believed 100% in God. And the cobbler told God, you know, if I could have just seen you one time, or maybe if I could have just heard your voice, or maybe if I could have just touched you once, I would have believed 100%. And God told the cobbler, he said, well, you remember one day you were working in your shop, and you looked out the window, there was snow on the ground, and there was a little girl coming down the street, and she was all cold and huddled up, and you went over to the door, and you got her, and you brought her in your shop, and you set her down, put your coat around so she could warm up, and you noticed she had holes in her shoes, so you went over and took her shoes off, and you put new soles on her shoes, and put her shoes back on, and you went back to work, and pretty soon you heard a sound, and you looked over the counter of your shop, and that little girl was leaving, and she got at the doorway. She stopped, and she turned, and she looked at you, and she smiled. And the cobbler told God, yeah, I remember that. He said, well, you remember one day you were in your shop, and an old bum come down the street, and he wanted to borrow some money to go get something to eat, and you didn't have any money because it took everything you had to provide for your family. So he said, well, I got a couple of sandwiches over here. If you want to sit down with me, I'll give you some of my lunch. And you sit down on that bench, and he sat down next to you, and you gave him a sandwich, and you took one without a word. You sit there, and you ate your lunch, and it came time to go back to work. You went back to work, and you were working away, and pretty soon you heard a noise, and he looked around, and the bum was getting ready to walk out of your shop, and he stopped, and just as he's getting ready to go through the door, he leaned over the counter, and he shook your hand. You remember that? The cobbler said, yeah, I remember that. He said, well, you remember one day there was a little old lady coming down the street, and she was crying and confused, and you looked out the window of your shop, and she was standing out there, and you brought her in and set her down and calmed her down, and you found out that she was lost, and her son was up the street, and you went up and found him and brought him down. She got calmed down, and you're working away, and it come time for her to leave, and just as she was going out the door, she said, bless you, my son. Do you remember that? And the cobbler said, yeah, I remember that. God said, well, the little girl's smile was my smile. And that bum's handshake was my touch, and that little old lady's bless you, my son, was my voice. I was there all the time. I just couldn't see, and I couldn't feel, and I couldn't hear. You can't see those things when you can't see those things. Now, on any given day, if I want to remember a time not too long ago when my little girl came home to see us and it was time for her to go back to where she lived in Italy, where her home is, and she's walking down the aisle there at that airport and she stops halfway down that aisle, get on that plane, and she turns and she smiles at me with that smile. If I want to think that's my God smiling at me, I can. Or maybe not too long ago, I don't know how long ago, a few months ago, I stood on the side of a hillside in a little town in Oklahoma with my father, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, me, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my stepmother was being buried that day, and I stood there, and he put his arm around me like a father should hold a son, and he hugged me, and he held me tight. If I want to believe that's my God holding me, I can believe that. Or maybe, I don't know what time it was, early this morning, I'm up in that room. There's a lady laying next to me, and she cuddles up next to me, and she says with a soft voice, I love you, baby. If I want to believe that's my God talking to me, I can. Now, you can say that ain't right, but you can't say I'm wrong because I'm sober, and I feel good about me. God bless, and thank you.